Imagine you're watching the game at a buddy's house when you get a call that someone tried to break into yours. In a second, everything can change. That's why there's ADT. No one wants to feel unsafe in their own home. ADT security systems help keep your home safe with 24/7 monitoring. The ADT Plus app keeps you in control the whole time. ADT's network is built for those game time moments. They have the most company-operated monitoring centers in the industry. Don't leave your home wide open during an emergency. When every second counts, count on ADT. Visit ADT.com or call 1-800-ADT-ASAP.
At California Closets, we design for the little things. Take this moment of a parent walking across their toy-filled living room for a glass of water. And now, the California Closets version of that moment. Family room and home storage solutions by designers who get you. California Closets. More room for what matters.
I don't think I've ever said this in public. A couple of people at Paramount used to refer to me as St. Charles. Because I would be able to, you know, calm the water.
Hey, I'm Deanna Riesenover.
And I'm Brian Dietzen.
And this is NCIS Partners and Probies.
This week, we have an extra, extra special guest.
Yes.
It's a person that's been with NCIS since the inception of the show, even prior to that on JAG. It's none other than our lovely friend, our executive producer, Charles Floyd Johnson.
Yes, and we do something that we have never done on this show before, and not even really on NCIS. We don't really do.
We don't do this at all.
Improvisations. Yes, and.
Oh, yes, and.
Yes. We improvise. This is such a wide-ranging show. We talk about Charles's, you know, career because he has had literal multiple things that he has done. Not just a producer.
No. This guy started out, he was a lawyer. He, of course, served in our military during the Vietnam conflict, war. He's
representing members of the military.
Members of the military in JAG. So, I mean, kind of art imitates life. He eventually became an executive producer of JAG. We're explaining too much of this because so much of this episode is so great. You're going to want to hear it from the man himself. Please stay tuned for Charles Floyd Johnson. Executive producer of NCIS, Charles Johnson. Charles, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. I'm really kind of thrilled to be here.
We are absolutely thrilled to have you.
Absolutely. You were the first face I remember from my audition, actually.
Really?
Yes, mine too.
Yes, actually.
Mine too.
Yes.
Both of you?
Yeah.
Yes.
I remember because you were front and center in my audition, right there.
You know, it's funny because I remember both of your auditions, but they were all so long ago. Even yours, which was newer, was what, 7 years ago?
I think eight at this point.
Oh my God, and yours. Yeah. Wow. We'll talk about yours.
20-something years ago, yeah.
Decades ago.
You are always, honestly though, you're always so front and center when I think of my time at NCIS. Like, I was like, you are so instrumental in sort of shaping the culture there, sort of shaping the voice of the show. Tell us what, just because, you know, we have people at home that may not exactly know what an EP does in this case. Tell us what an executive producer for NCIS like yourself does.
Oh my gosh. You know, it's funny because I never want to talk about what producers do because most of the time you're talking to people in who are not in the industry, and you could be at a cocktail party and they go, what does a producer do?
I'm laughing because this is the only thing producers don't want to talk about. They'll talk about anything,
anything else
except
that.
What a producer does.
You know, because it's such a multitasking job. Mm-hmm. You kind of have to do everything.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I had learned to do budgets. Mm-hmm. I had to learn to do what production designers do and stunt people do. Because you can't do those jobs or you're not doing those jobs, but you got to know what they are.
Right.
You got to know how to motivate people to do them, and you got to know how to keep them on track. So, you know, I used to have to go location scouting and go all over the place. So, and I started, so you both know, as an associate producer doing post-production.
Really?
Because when I first started many, many moons ago, I would do the voiceovers and do looping and inserts.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And inserts for everybody who knows. You know when a character kind of says like, oh, I don't know, it's got to be this book. And they hold it up and you see kind of a close-up. That's an insert.
That's an insert.
Looping is something like, you know, when you mess up a line, which...
Yeah. Additional dialogue recording called ADR.
ADR, so, yeah.
Some a little bit of fumbles of a line, they have the actor go back in and re-record it.
Jim Garner used to call me the scourge of the looping room.
Why?
He hated doing it. And, you know, in those days when we were doing ADR... It wasn't really as sophisticated as now. So loops would stand out. You had to kind of like do them so that, you know, it didn't go like, there's a loop.
Yeah.
And the science of it all and the technology wasn't anywhere near what it is today, where sometimes you can't even tell. So that was how I started.
Do you know why they call it looping? I don't. Do you know? Is there like
a... No, I don't know, except that maybe what they were doing was on a loop when they, you know, when you were doing the thing and they would do it several times. I don't...
Because it was on reel, because it was reel to reel editing. Yeah, so now probably. everything's digital, but it used to be those like old film casters you see, like literally the tapes. Yeah,
and
literally
you would sometimes have to do those kind of things 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times because you would play, you'd do playback.
Yeah.
Right.
And you would hear that it didn't sound like the original dialogue. Occasionally now, even now with the technology, sometimes a loop will stand out, but it's rare.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I started out doing. And then I just had to learn to do everything. And then I wanted to learn to write.
Yeah.
So I had to go to my producers and say, you know, I like my job, but I want to know more. And so they would let me sit in writing rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wrote stories and a few scripts. My first script I wrote was not very good because I was doing a lot of post-production and I was, it was the last episode of Rockford Files. And I thought, you know, I could be brilliant when I write, how foolish I was. I turned it in and David Chase and Stephen Cannell, who were the producers, exec producers of the show, went, it's not very good, Charles. And they rewrote it. And I said, you guys take credit. So they let me have story credit, but they have it. So as a producer, I've just learned to do everything. In fact, one other thing I'll tell you about being EP is I also used to think that you talk about being front and center in the show. I also find that being an EP, even earlier a producer, because I get along with the cast most of the time. Mm-hmm. I was very good at that. But sometimes people would have problems. Mm-hmm. You guys never did, but I would have people come into my office and like be just distraught. How do I get through this? I had one of the leading actors come to me and say, I just want to do it anymore. I want to quit.
Oh, wow.
And I had to talk him off a ledge.
Yeah.
So I decided that what I would do is put a sign up on my door, which I never did, that the doctor is in. So that's part of being an EP. You just do it all.
Yeah.
And then one last thing I talk about, and I know we can move on to other things, being an executive producer also can mean different things doing different mediums.
Mm-hmm.
There are different things. EP can mean different things in a movie,
mm-hmm.
where sometimes an EP can be just an investor.
Right.
Or in Broadway, the same thing. Or it can be, you know, where you're the showrunner and you're the creator or you're the administrator of the show. So it just varies. So that's why I veer away from it. But I'm glad you asked.
I'm actually curious because now we never do this on here, but I want to do a little role play. This is not real. I'm not going anywhere. But let's do a little role play of what this is like. Because actually, I'm curious. I'm like, teach me what it is like to talk someone down. Because I have a need to be talked down because I like to keep a job. But let's pretend I've come to your office. Here I am.
Yeah.
Hold on. Let me get into it. Right. I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't do the show anymore. I'm sorry. I got to quit.
Wait. We got to talk about this, right?
I don't think I can talk about it. What do I do? How do I get out of this?
Well, first of all, you have to think about the fact that you're letting everybody down, including yourself.
Right, right.
If you don't stay.
Oh, God.
And the problems that it creates. Maybe what we could do is find a way to give you a break and give you maybe a lighter, you know, storyline in a couple of episodes.
This is perfect. Thank you so much. Okay. So you guys have it here,
Charles,
on camera.
Charles,
that
I
got
to talk to you.
Great.
Okay. I want to quit.
Oh,
sorry. You're already in here.
No, I was just going to make you sure. I just wanted it on camera that I get Fridays off from now on.
Okay. All right. Great. I want to quit. Can I have 2 days off a week? Has that ever happened?
Yes. We've never
played this card before.
No, we haven't. But
but probably I would say to you, we negotiate. I'd say, yeah. I get it. I understand it, and we understand. Maybe one day every other week.
Okay. Well, speaking of negotiating, I wanted to take it back. Prior to you being a producer on television,
yeah.
You're a lawyer.
Yeah, that's and true.
And you graduated from Howard?
Howard, yeah. Mm-hmm. Undergrad and graduate school.
Undergrad and graduate school. Yeah. And you also served in the military, correct?
I did.
Give us a little taste of what the beginnings of Charles Johnson is pre-executive.
Well, first of all, I think you guys may know this. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be an actor.
Yes.
That was where I started.
I did not know
you that. You did not know that.
I did not know that.
Yeah. In the book A Gathering of Voices, which is the anthology I contributed to, there's a story called Soda Fountain Diaries. Mm-hmm. And it talks about growing up at 5, 6, 7, 8 years old in a soda shop that my mom and dad had. Mm-hmm. Television was very early then. And I used to watch all those early shows. And I would go, I want to do that.
Yeah.
At 8 years old. Mm. I didn't know how to do it. I was in a little town in Delaware. Had no knowledge of what that was all about. And I couldn't think, I didn't want to know what a producer, writer, right. director was, but I could see what actors were.
Yeah.
Sure.
So when I went off to, I went to boarding school and I did some declamation contests and stuff like that. Because, you know, I was always dabbling in trying to be an actor. And then in college, I was in a group called the Howard Players. And then I wanted to go off to New York to do the Neighborhood Playhouse, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. where Sanford Meisner was teaching. Mm-hmm. And my mom and dad said, are you crazy? Mm-hmm. We spent all this time giving you an education, and why don't you just go to law school? You talk well. So why don't you go to law school and take it as a winter resort? And after, you know, a semester or two, if you don't like it, we'll support you.
Yeah.
Well, they knew me better than I did, because I finished law school. I was on the Law Journal at Howard, and I passed the bar. But when I got out, I didn't want to be a lawyer. I worked for the government for about 3 years. And I was a lawyer. I traveled overseas. Mm-hmm. I worked in Sweden and Paris, and got a job in Paris. And I thought, I don't want to do that. It was at UNESCO. I don't want to turn 30 and not have tried being an actor.
Right.
So I gave
you couldn't shake it.
I couldn't shake it. So wow. I gave it all up.
And wait, and what kind of lawyer were you, just to clarify?
I was a copyright and a patent lawyer.
Okay, very different than acting.
Very different.
Okay.
And I used to, during that time when I was working for the offices, I was doing plays all over D.C.
Wow.
Community theater, regional theater, because I would work 8 to 5.
Yeah.
And then from 5 on, I was doing theater. Mm-hmm. If I wasn't in rehearsal, I was doing a play.
Right.
I must have done 20. And then I had to go, your point, I had to go to Vietnam. It was during the Vietnam conflict.
Okay.
And I had to go into the military. I ended up, because I had a law degree, working for the JAG.
No kidding.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, life meets art.
I didn't know that.
Wow, yeah. I had no idea.
And I worked as what they call a courts and boards attorney, as a JAG officer. I was non-commissioned, because I hadn't finished the bar when I did that. Mm-hmm. But I defended something like 350 courts martials.
Wow.
Most of them were AWOLs and minor things.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I did that. And then when I got out, I couldn't shake it. So I came to California, didn't know anybody, started all over again, found a little acting school in Hollywood at El Centro and Santa Monica called Professional Theater Workshop. Mm-hmm. And I went there for about a year. And I did a little acting and found an agent, you know, all those things.
Yeah.
Did a commercial and then I needed a job, and I was doing a play. And my friends said, my husband works at Universal, mm-hmm. and he's in business affairs. You should go have lunch with him. Mm-hmm. And he was a wonderful man. He's gone now. And he helped me get in. I worked in the mailroom for 3 days at Universal. I probably have the shortest career in the mailroom. Because what happened was, it's a confluence of things where I got there. The EEOC was pressing studios to hire minorities. This was 1970.
What is the EEOC?
Equal Employment Opportunities Commission.
Yeah. Okay.
And they...
Year was this then?
This was like 71, 72.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And there weren't a lot of African-Americans behind the cameras. Mm-hmm. Mm. And so the studios were kind of looking to, how do we do that? And I was perfect. I had a law degree. And I had, I was now at the studio because I was in the mailroom. Mm-hmm. And 3 days later, they called and said, you're moving to business affairs. I had an interview there.
Yeah.
And my friend was working there. And I went there for about 3.5 years. And then one day I got a call from the producers of the show, The Rockford Files, that I was working on. And they had an upheaval on the show. Mm-hmm. And they called me, and I was their production coordinator. And they said, how would you like to be an associate producer?
Wow.
And that's how it happened. And I kind of like how you serendipitous. Yeah. Our lives are often like that. And I thought about it for about 24 hours. And I thought, I could maybe always elect to be an actor.
Yeah.
But I can't always be sure that somebody's going to come up and say, you want to be an associate producer. So,
right.
When I was going to say, where was the acting bug at this point?
Well, it's still there.
Yeah.
And I would go to dailies. You know, now we look at those things on video and, mm-hmm. and in your office and stuff. But then we used to go into a room mm-hmm. and watch on the screen.
Yeah.
And I would see my fellow friends who were actors who were doing three lines in a show in dailies. And I'd go, what's wrong with that picture? They're there and I'm here. I want to be up there. But slowly it went away.
Why?
Well, because the more I did it, the more I liked it. I was working at Universal Studios when they were doing 16, 17, 18 hours of television.
Yeah.
And I got to work on a ton of shows. And I got to meet and work with a lot of producers. Mm-hmm. Some who were more inviting than others. Mm-hmm. I always thought some of them were pedagogic in the fact that they would invite me in and I'd go to scoring sessions and I'd go to looping sessions and dubbing sessions and I'd sit in on screening things. I was working on finding directors and writers for shows. Mm-hmm. So, it just got better at it. And I thought, I'm probably better at that than I am as an actor.
I don't know. You jumped right into that improv.
Well,
you jumped right in, man.
But I worked at that for a long time. But I was never, I watch you guys, and you are so good at what you do, and you whatever. I was never truly comfortable behind the camera. Mm. I mean, in front of the camera. I just really wasn't. I always knew it was there. Mm. I had a few instances when I acted where I sort of got involved enough that I didn't think about the fact that I was acting.
Yeah.
But I never learned to go that next step that you guys do, where you just kind of, it's second nature and the camera's not there.
Do you feel that?
That I can just go without having...
That the camera's not there.
There are times for sure, yeah.
I'm a moth to a flame, baby. You put a camera in front of me, I'm very aware of it, but that's...
Well, but you don't show it.
No, but I'm saying that instinct did not have... I think that is a good instinct, personally, what you're describing.
Yeah, yeah.
And now I'm encouraging you to act.
Well, I do a little bit. Yeah. Now, this is something you guys don't know, but in the 80s, I produced a television special for PBS called Voices of Our People in Celebration of Black Poetry. Mm-hmm. And I worked with a number of actors who were were heavily working actors. Mm-hmm. Robert Hooks, Brock Peters, Denise Nicholas, and they were all acting in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And I was working as an actor with them, but I started producing it. Mm-hmm. And at one point, one of the actors couldn't do it, and I went on. And so we started doing this poetry all up and down the West Coast. Mm-hmm. As a theater piece. And one day somebody at PBS came to us and said, well, how would you guys do this for the television? And we said, why not? And so I produced it and I acted in it. And we won 6 Emmys.
Wow.
For performing. And I won an Emmy for performing.
Wow.
So,
wow.
So I was kind of thrilled that I got a chance to do that. And so it paid off. I thought, mom and dad, it wasn't quite a folly.
Right.
And so I have that. And then I was a recur on JAG. Did you guys know that?
This I did hear. Yeah, I did hear.
I was a recur on
this.
JAG. I did 4 episodes as a forensics, whatever you call them, in the lab. And I did it about 4 times. And then I did 1 NCIS mm-hmm. early on. I think it's called The Boneyard.
And
it plays all the time.
Wow. And
I had 2 lines in a scene with Harmon and Spano.
Hey, but those residuals keep coming, baby.
Well, I do get them occasionally. Of course, you know, not $10, you know, whatever they are, but okay, speaking not of, like yours.
I just find this so inspiring that one, at a time when there were almost no African Americans behind the camera, you were inspired and you were like, let me do this. And probably at a time when you were watching growing up, there were not a lot of African Americans on TV, or if they were, they probably weren't necessarily the more positive roles that we see.
Well, they weren't, yeah. There are two phases of that, and I'll make it short. There were African Americans who had little variety shows.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Paul Mooney. And
well, no, but long before Paul Mooney. Oh, okay. Nat King Cole. Nat King Cole had almost the very first variety show on television in like 55, and it was 15 minutes. I always used to call them
15 minutes.
15 minutes. I used to call them 15 minutes of fame.
And we're back to that now. Vertical drama. We're back to
that. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And Hazel Scott, Billy Daniels, those people. And then there were the people who played houseworkers. Right. You know, there was a woman named Beulah, Ethel Waters, and people. And they were the maids and the butlers. Mm-hmm. That was primarily a lot of that. It was either the entertainers.
Yeah.
Or people playing subservient roles. That's pretty much early television. But this is before you both were long thought of. This was this 50s, 60s. So I watched that whole evolution. You know, by the time we got to the 80s, and African Americans were now playing doctors, lawyers, and, you know, whatever. But it took a while to get there. And there was a whole period in the 70s, which you guys read about, but it was the whole black exploitation period.
Mm-hmm.
There were lots of pimps and whores, mm-hmm. and all that stuff that we played. So we've been through the gamut of it all, and I've seen a lot of it. But yeah, so I would love to act some more. Maybe one time I might, but the bug is gone now. I used to love to go on stage and sit and watch you guys work. Mm-hmm. And then after you've done 40 years of that, you go, oh, I'll go down once a week as opposed to every day. You know, it just changes, you know.
Yeah. Look, he won an Emmy.
He won an Emmy
for acting and for producing. I got my choices.
I'm still Pile Shrine.
Matching outfits, extravagant birthdays, many nicknames, a few classic moves of a dog-obsessed parent. At Ollie, they're obsessed with how obsessed you are with your pup, which is why they obsess over giving your dog the best. Ollie's fresh, human-grade recipes are developed by real chefs and backed by vet nutritionists. The meals are perfectly portioned and come with a puptainer and scoop for easy storing and mess-free serving, delivering the best experience for you and your pup. And through the Ollie app, you can actually check in on your dog's health with real vets. By uploading a picture, their team can check your dog's weight, digestion, teeth, and coat. They'll then provide next steps on how to keep them thriving. And because they're just as obsessed as you are, there's zero judgment if you check in every day. You could say Ollie feeds the obsession. Go to ollie.com/firstbox and use code FIRSTBOX to get 70% off your welcome kit. Ollie, feed the obsession.
I wanted to ask you, speaking of JAG, speaking of NCIS, how did you meet Don Belisario?
Yeah, that, you know, so many of these stories are so circuitous in terms of how they happened. But Belisario started in the industry late in life, maybe when he was in his 40s.
Yeah.
And he had already, but he was a producer before he started writing of commercials. He worked for a big commercial firm in Texas. And he was very good at what he did. And he would, the reason I think he became such a talented producer is because when you do 30-second and 60-second commercials, they almost have to have a beginning, middle, and end.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of learned to do that in that format. But he was also very talented because out of Penn State, he became a journalist. And so he was always a good writer. And when he got to Hollywood, he wrote a script, got an agent. They got him to Steve Cannell, who was producing The A-Team and Bubba Black Sheep. And suddenly they just hired him right away. He became like one of the young Turks at 40 on the Universal lot. And I was working, doing an associate producer while I was still doing Rockford on Baba Black Sheep in my hiatus, I did that pilot with Cannell. Belisario then came on when the series went as a writer. And so we were in the same orbit, in the same set of offices, although I went back to Rockford. So I knew him before, even before. Now, cut two, Magnum P.I. comes up. They have a script at Universal. They want to do it, and Tom Selleck wants to do it. But they don't like the script that much, and they give it to Don Belisario, who writes a brilliant script, then becomes the, you know, executive producer of that series and creator. And in the first or second year, they have problems on the show. They're shooting in Hawaii. And they want somebody like who's worked on Rockford.
Right.
Because that show had humor and they know it. But everybody's busy. Cannell's gone off to do Cannell Productions. David Chase has gone off to do Almost Grown. Of course, later Sopranos. And another writer, Juanita Bartlett, went off to do In the Heat of the Night. So I was the only person around. And Don knew me. And Tom knew me. Because Tom had done a character on Rockford called Lance White. Mm-hmm. Something White and Nearly Perfect. And he was so good, which is really got his attention. So it was a perfect storm.
Tom Selleck was on Rockford Files? Yeah. Was it like a recurring
role? No, they did one episode. Everybody loved it. He was Lance White. You got to see this episode.
Yeah.
He was a gorgeous guy. Perfect detective who does everything wrong and it turns out right. And Rockford does everything right and it turns out wrong. And they actually did a second episode. But the attention was at the studios and at the networks that Selleck was so good, they wanted to do this pilot with him, and that's how it happened. So, but I got a call to go work on the show. And Belisario knew me, and he called me up one day, and hey, guy, Deb, they called you to work on a show. I said, no, nobody's called me. Well, they're going to call you because I want you. Wow. And so that's how we started. And then I was going to hire to work on Magnum in L.A. They sent me to Hawaii for a week to get to meet everybody and know everybody. And while I was there, one of the producers got fired. And they said to me, could you stay for a week and just till we get somebody? And I thought, I don't know. Well, of course, I wanted to stay, but I thought,
yeah.
I can't cop so fast to that. I said, well, yeah, if you need me to. I was the producer who came to dinner. I never left.
Right. Yeah.
I stayed 6 years on that show.
No
and they,
kidding.
They'd already done a year and a half when I got there.
Are you your boots on the ground in Hawaii then?
Yeah, and that was frightening to me. Okay. I was so afraid. In truthful, even though I wanted to stay, that they would find me out for the fraud I was, because I had never worked alone on a series, boots on the ground, the head producer with the actors and with a crew that was kind of a local crew. The Hawaiian culture was very different.
Yeah.
And I had to kind of like step up fast, and so I was pretty nervous, but I survived.
How?
Well, I'm pretty adaptable.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty, I listen.
Yes.
I work hard and I gain the confidence of the cast and the crew really fast. Mm. I mean, listen, I was this producer. I was a supervising producer in Hawaii within 6 months of being in the show. And then I went from that to a co-exec producer. I think I was co-exec when I left that show. But I stayed with it for many years. We got nominated for a couple Emmys. Mm-hmm. And I didn't mention to you, but my second Emmy was for Rockford before I got to. That was just, I was in the business like 4 or 5 years when I got my first Emmy for producing Rockford. I thought, dear God, how did this happen? But wow. So that's how I met Belisario. And then he liked me enough that I stayed on and I did... Baba was just earlier. What did I do with him afterwards? I can't even keep up.
Has to be Quantum Leap.
Yeah.
It was Quantum Leap. Yeah. That's right. And then I went on to JAG, which went 9 years.
Right.
And then while I was doing the end of JAG, I then started doing NCIS when you guys started. And then he did a show called First Monday, which was about the Supreme Court
Monday.
That only didn't last a long time with Joe Mantegna.
And Jim Garner again, right?
Jim Garner again.
Yes.
And also Mantegna and Charles Durning. It was a wonderful cast. Didn't last long, but I liked it because also it was a show now, a legal show.
Yeah.
I got to do legal show on JAG and then a legal show on First Monday. So there's where my education came in. But that's how I ended up doing 5 shows at Don.
Wow.
and lasted with him that long. I go back with him till 1982.
And was Charles Durning, was he on NCIS?
Yes. He was nominated for an Emmy. Yes.
Yeah. You got the touch, man.
I've been lucky. That, you know, much of my career has been serendipitous. I just kind of went from one thing to the next. I kind of wished I had written more, because I think writers get the best chances to shepherd material and create. And I was just more of an administrator a great deal of my career. Good at it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, shows got created, and then I would come on and stay with them and keep them going.
Well, you're obviously so good with just speaking to people on a human level. You did that on our show. That was my entire experience with you. If there's an issue, just go to Charles and you can sit and talk it through. Or even if there's not an issue, you just want to check in with someone from production. Charles is the guy who will have an ear for everyone. Is that what made your relationship with Belisario successful? I mean, you did 5 shows, and all 5 of which were successful. Did you compliment each other in some way?
You've never laughed like that in front of me. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I marvel at my ability to work with Don, because we were very different.
Yes,
we were very much so. Very different people. He was, you know, Don Belisario from the beginning, you know, he kind of, mm-hmm. Sometimes difficult to work with. He was brilliant at what he did. I think I was the diplomat. He's actually referred to me I've read a couple of articles where he's mentioned me, and he's said I could have been in the diplomatic corps. And I think a lot of times, because Don was always about the product, it was all about how good it was.
Sure.
He wasn't always worried about what the budgets were, and what the politics were.
He's a wonderful writer.
Great.
Extremely, and a wonderful writer, a wonderful editor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And a good producer in the way he wrote work, but he sometimes didn't want to deal with the craziness that they wanted to impose on him. Mm. And that was where the conflict came. And I was at one time referred to, I don't think I've ever said this in public, a couple of people at Paramount used to refer to me as St. Charles, because I would be able to, you know, calm the waters when, you know, because Don could come in, not like a script, 3 days before shooting and tear it up and say, we got to start over.
Yeah.
Now, somebody has to be there to keep that ship going, where everybody's losing their minds and cost is going up. And I guess I just had that ability to do it. I don't even know how I had it, but it was there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to have had a career that has lasted from 71 till now, which is 55 years, and working all the way up until heavily until last year, when I kind of just said, I need to move on.
Mm-hmm.
And I was never out of work. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing. Mm-hmm.
And you're still working. I just want to point that out.
No, I'm still
you're
working.
Literally
I'm still
produced
still,
a
I'm
show.
Still working,
you know? Produced a show that we were both in.
Yeah.
And that, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm working on, you know, a film now, and I'm working on a documentary about the Congressional Black Caucus, and I'm writing my memoir. And then working on a theatrical show, they're mm-hmm. trying to see where that would go. So no, I don't have much time to worry about what to do next. But it's nice. I miss you guys. But it's nice to kind of be able to move on to another level, especially at my age. I just had a birthday. I'm going to tell you how old I am. But it's getting up there.
Was there a moment where you sort of looked at the show and you said, I've made my mark. I did it. Like, is there something you can sort of pinpoint?
Were you referring to when I worked on NCIS?
Yeah.
I was ready to leave the show probably 5, 6, 7 years before I ever did. I kind of thought I had done it all. Because, you know, I didn't think that show was going to last 23 years.
Yeah.
So when they came to you and they said, we want a spinoff from JAG, the legal show that's been on for 9 years.
Yeah.
You didn't think it would go for 23 years and be the most popular television?
Maybe 5, 6, 7.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what, yeah.
Yeah, maybe 5. The reason I thought that is because, you know, a couple of Don shows had gone, Quantum Leap went about 5.
Mm.
Magnum went about 8.
Mm-hmm.
but a couple others went. So I thought, you know, it could have a good run, but 10 years, by the time we got to 10, I was like, what?
Yeah.
Pinch me, you know. But I was very lucky to be on a show that, you know, did so well. But I was ready to leave, but it was hard to leave because everybody wanted me to stay. Mm-hmm. Or at least I thought they did. They kept coming back to me. Every year I kept thinking, they go, he's an elder statesman, you know, we can save money. But they never did. They would come back and I would be in shock. But finally I thought, it's time. So when we got to year 22, I had actually told Steve Binder and David Staff and Amy that I wanted to kind of move on. But and they were very sad, but they understood because I'd been there a long time.
Yeah, I'm glad you stayed because it sounds like some of that time was during the beginning of my tenure and you're such a steadying hand.
Yeah.
You're such a like calming force.
Yeah, I thank you for that. But I've heard that from a lot of cast and crew. And I get notes now from some of our cast and crew saying, you know, how are you? We miss you. And that's always nice and reassuring to hear. Yeah. But I've had a great career. Let's face it. And not one that I planned. It wasn't.
Right.
I didn't have this, you know, board up there that, you know, storyboard. This next. It just kind of happened.
When it comes to NCIS specifically, I mean, I'm more familiar, obviously, with NCIS than I am with JAG, Quantum Leap, or Rockford Files.
Yeah.
What story or storylines did you think really connected with, or that you may have championed? I know that you're a champion of a great story when you come into it. Deanna and I just worked with you on a theatrical production of Owl and the Pussycat
right. Not
long ago, and it was strictly because you loved this play, this story. Mm-hmm. Tell us about any storylines or anything, perhaps even just characters along the way that we've met in NCIS that you said, now there's something, there's something that's really important for the world to see.
Brian, there's so many because 23 years and oftentimes 20 episodes a season.
Oh yeah.
You know, there are so many, but I think I gravitated a lot of times on NCIS to the more serious stories. Mm-hmm. That I remember one. Well, of course, the pilot was extraordinary. It's a great pilot, and it's one of my favorites. But I remember one where everybody had to go underwater. You remember that one?
Was that where Gibbs is underwater?
Yeah, under, and then Weatherly has to go under. And
oh, Requiem.
Requiem, yeah. I love that one. But there's so many. I used to love the storylines with Cody and Michael. And they were lots of fun.
Mm-hmm. That's been somewhat popular, yeah.
Yeah, and of course that led to that spinoff. And then Harmon was just a wonderful actor on that show. Mm-hmm. It was great because one of the hallmarks of my career, nothing that I think I did would have fell into, was working on series that had humor.
Mm.
And that was true of Rockford. It was true of Magnum, which is certainly Quantum Leap. There was a little in JAG. And there was a huge amount in NCIS. And I've worked with a lot of cast because I did several movies of the week and stuff like that in addition to the series. But the cast that we had on JAG was just amazing.
Yeah.
And every time we replaced somebody, I would think there's a hole in the fabric. Right. And yet it would come out and we just had these wonderful new characters and new people.
Right.
I find that with both of you in terms of your work and, you know, you had to follow Pauly Perrette and yet you etched a character that's very different and very, very real and very much fun from her. You had to go in the shoes and follow David and now you're David and now you're, you know, you've made that your own. And then watching you two play, that's how I thought of you for Owl and Pussycat. I used to watch your interplay in all those scenes you would do in the lab and in forensics, and you guys had such humor that I thought these people are perfect if they'll do it. So I was so glad you did it. But I probably have 50, 60 favorite episodes.
Right.
On NCIS. But most of all, I'm proud of the casting and the cast. And also, we can't forget that the crew is amazing.
Yes.
And a number of those people have been together, first on JAG, now on this show. I stay in touch with Carla Dean. You know, she's been there from the beginning, and we were together on JAG.
So Carla Dean is our head hairstylist on the show.
But there's just others. We could go on forever talking about all those people. So, and you're only as good. Remember this, you two. You're only as good as the team that you surround you.
To that end, like both of us remember you being front and center there in casting.
Yeah.
And both of us have also had the opportunity to write for the show. And in every casting session, you were right there. You were front and center, and you are the guy who has all the notes on each one of the actors, person that we looked at. And I think that was kind of the way I saw you was that you're the team builder. You're the person that's going to put all this together, because this whole machine is only as good as its parts, right? And really? So really the cast and how we get that show on television each week, I feel like you were the champion at the front of all of it.
Well, it turned out to be that way in many ways. Thank you. And I was particularly good at casting, but maybe because I wanted to be an actor.
Yeah.
And so I liked actors and I enjoyed them. And I was friendly with all the casting directors because, you know, I would watch, go to theater.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I would watch lots of television and I'd be aware of who the actors were in different shows. It got harder as we got more into it because there are so many actors.
500 television shows to keep track of.
500 television shows to keep me up. But early on, but I think I was good at it. And I was front and center a lot of time. I got a note from Binder the other day, and he said, "Boy, I do miss you in casting." And I thought, oh, I'm glad to know I'm
that is Steve Binder, our showrunner, of course, reaching out to Charles on the first year that you are not on our set all the time.
On the casting,
This is very interesting because getting to hear so much about your career, all the times that you've been fearless. I mean, we didn't even have a chance to talk about, you know, the media forum that you started in the 80s to change the way. We were talking a little bit about the way African-Americans were portrayed.
Yeah.
And this was started to combat that, correct?
Yeah. It started. We started in the late 70s and went into the early 80s. And we had a ton of African-American people who were working in television and film in front of behind the cameras to be in the forum. And we would have these seminars where we'd get tons of people to come speak to us. And we'd have like 700 or 800 people at a time at the Mark Taper Forum. Yeah. And we'd keep pressure on studios and networks. A man who is gone now, Gordon Davison, who used to run the Mark Taper Theater, was so good to us. And on Mondays they were dark and we'd use the theater and we did all that stuff. We kept it going, and I became one of the officers of that. But I feel very proud of that you mentioned it, because I was at the forefront of trying to make sure that images were properly accorded and that we were able to do a wider range of casting. Wow. And that's now happened now. We're much better in terms of what we do. I just read the other day that there's some big stage production coming up with Lupita Nyong'o, who's going to play Helen of Troy.
Yes, that's right. She is. Yes,
how
yes,
far
yes.
Are we
I saw
come?
That. Yes, you I'm know, very excited about that.
Elon Musk is not happy about that. Tough shop. Yeah. Tough stuff. But there's just been a lot of growth, and some of that was when I first started with the people I worked with.
And it's important because, you know, when you tell me that you were watching TV in the 50s and there wasn't a great, you know, it's not just about African Americans. It's hopefully if you show people like, look, this person can do it. Maybe other people, you know, like lots of different people can start and we can really start these conversations. But just kind of to wrap up before we get to our appropriate questions, you've pivoted so much. And even now, kind of, you know, after 55 years, you're pivoting again because you're pivoting to theater a bit. How do you remain fearless?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure I think about it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes, you're welcome. But I'm not sure I think about it. I think I just do.
Yeah.
I just dive in. It's not without fear of failing because it's there, but you just have to kind of tuck that behind.
Yeah.
And then you know, get into the fray of it all.
Yeah.
And that's what I've done. Somebody says, how do you do this? And I'm not sure, but I just like, okay, I'll try. And I'm so much a team player that mm-hmm. it keeps going. And I would love to slow down because I would love to go to the south of France and stay 6 months and just hang out on the beach.
Yeah.
But it's just not in the cards for me.
Yeah, yeah, fair. Yeah. And thank you for trusting us because I know during that play process.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes. Yeah,
yes, yes. That was trust.
That was trust because I was freaking out.
I know. That's the only time I've ever seen you nervous.
Yeah, I was freaking out because, I thought, should we have another rehearsal or two? And then you guys said, no, we need to go home and study this and get with it. And then day of was like, whoa. So that was trust.
Well, we get to do probie questions now.
Okay. Probie questions.
A lot has changed since Bob's Discount Furniture opened its first store 35 years ago. Car phones have become cell phones, grunge band hits have become oldies, and you can order furniture online. But what hasn't changed is the way they do business, aka the Bob's way. Doing things the Bob's way means that when I shop at Bob's, I know I'll find the latest top-rated styles like the Aspen sofa for just $399, bedrooms with storage and charging, Consumer Reports recommended mattresses, real marble dining sets, and more. All at 90s-era prices. There's even no money-down financing and lightning-fast shipping, so you aren't stuck waiting months for your furniture to arrive. Plus, Bob's still makes furniture shopping fun with friendly associates and cafes full of free treats and ice cream. Want to see for yourself? Stop into your local Bob's store this Labor Day weekend to party it up like it's 1991 and celebrate 35 years of doing things the Bob's way.
How would you like to live in a home where the floors are always clean? Now you can with Matic, the first intuitive cleaning robot designed and assembled in America for families like yours. Matic sees your home the way you do, so it cleans the way you would. Precise visual navigation means it moves gracefully through real lived-in spaces and almost never gets stuck. Its visual intelligence means you can point at a mess and say, Matic, clean this. Matic also understands over 75 languages, so anyone can use it just by talking to it, even the kids and the grandparents. Nobody has to learn another app. It vacuums and mops daily, it's quiet enough to run at night, and can clean in the dark, so you can wake up to clean floors. Matic is rated 4.9 out of 5 by the families who own it. To get your Matic, go to maticrobots.com. That's maticrobots.com, and get a year's supply of free HEPA bags with your purchase today. Go to maticrobots.com/odyssey, a $96 value at no cost to you. That's maticrobots.com/AUDACY.
Squarespace is not only the best place to build your website, but to discover new domains too. Something like topfootballcamp.com for your top football camp, whisperingbloom.com for your silent retreat, or whisperingboom.com for your shouting retreat. Maybe velvetchords.com for your music studio, or existentialglitter.com for your artist studio. With a website from Squarespace, you can build your brand and your business all at squarespace.com. Get your domain before they're gone with offer code MAKEITREAL for 10% off your domain or website.
Every single week we put out the call on social media.
Yeah.
Here's who we're having in this week, Mr. Charles Floyd Johnson. Mm-hmm. And fans of the show, who are lovingly referred to as probies, send in their questions for you. Mm-hmm. So strap in. We're about to hit some questions for
all
you.
All right.
Do you have one ready for
I
you?
I do have one. All okay. Right. Do you want to? Sometimes we read them together, but I'll let you read it.
All right. Okay. So from the universe of
NCIS. I want to hold it though.
From the universe of NCIS or JAG, is there any character that you would bring back to the show?
You can hold it now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're done with it.
Thank you. I'm done.
Okay. Any character I would bring back to the show?
Yeah. Any character that you would bring back? You could even go back to the JAG days because it's the same universe.
You look disturbed right now.
I am because there are so many.
That? Oh, gosh. What kind
it's
of
like,
question
it's
is
like,
that?
How do you pick your children? Whatever. There's just so many. I'm gonna pun on this one and say there are a lot. I'll tell you one that I wish we could do, and he never made it to the screen. Mm. When we were trying to find Mark Harmon's dad in NCIS.
Yes.
We decided that we were going to go after James Garner.
Oh, right. Yes.
And I was at in the mix of that because I had worked with him a lot over the years. And so we got him to do it. He didn't really want to do it at first. And he did do it. And then when he did it, he liked the script. And he came to the read-through. Mm-hmm. And he went to wardrobe. And we had this great day with him. And we, everybody thought, you know, this is heaven. And then he went home. And that night, he had a stroke. And he never, ever did the role. And it's just one of those missed things.
Yeah.
And we were all very sad. But surprisingly, Susan Bluestein or someone came up with the father that Ralph...
Ralph Waite.
Waite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who was perfect.
He was.
And the public never knew
right.
that he was not it, that Garner was the original guy. And they kind of looked alike. You know, they both had that gray hair and kind of a physiognomy, kind of a similar thing. So, yeah, that would, if I could have made that work.
Yeah.
But that was not in the cards. But that stood out for me. I had to think about that for a while.
That was a very interesting episode, too.
Yes.
Because at that table read, you saw David McCallum, who played Dudley, of course, walk up to James Garner. And they had not spent a ton of time together since
what was that?
Filming The Great Escape. You know, back in, what year was that? 67?
I think 60, like late 60s, yeah.
Yeah, and it was pretty incredible to see these two, you know, legends together.
And, of course, they were very young men when they did that movie. Yeah. And it was a great cast, that movie.
That's a good answer.
I think that would be something I would like to see have happened.
I like that.
Good.
All right, you're going to read this one, and I'm going to hold it.
Okay, great. It's upside down. Is it easy to reinvent yourself after more than 20 years?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. But
what's the secret?
Sometimes you have to do it.
Yeah, what's the secret?
What's the secret?
Oh, come on. The secret sauce, huh?
We're in season 23.
Yeah.
How do we reinvent the whole thing?
Maybe you become a bad guy.
Maybe Jimmy just, yeah.
Maybe you like the dead bodies, you know.
Ooh, Jimmy's becomes a little Dextery.
Ooh,
yeah.
That's kind of weird.
You come down into autopsy and there's plastic on the floor. And
hey, man.
Who knows?
Keeps the raids up.
Yeah, it's kind of hard. But, you know, I think our writers, and you guys have in that category, and you've done good episodes. I think they've done very well with helping us to evolve characters. Mm. Well, I think one of the strengths of NCIS is that audience gets involved in who you are who the characters are. And they follow that journey. And there's been such a long string of time where the characters have evolved that there are times when I've seen things from guests and viewers where they remember stuff I don't remember. I mean, I remember when they say it, but it's gone. But they follow and they know the trajectory of your character and of Harmon's character. And we had so many wonderful people. And there have been, in addition to the regular cast, we have had great recurs who've come on that show and done arcs of five and six and seven shows where they're just wonderful. And you almost think of them as regulars because they're so good. But I think that's a credit to our casting director, to Susan and to Jason and all and Christy and all those people. And then I think you guys make it such a welcome set for the people you come on and work with you.
Harmon taught me that.
Yeah.
Taught me that. Yeah. He's a great
He's a master at that.
Yes.
And I think you guys do it. And I've gotten letters from people talking about, and I find it hard to believe, but people have done a number of guest star roles and they say, I had the best time on that set. It was just a warm feeling. And letters come out of the blue sometimes. And, you know, you appreciate those hearing that. But I think you guys do make it that way. I think it's one, and I've worked on a lot of sets. You know, I had to think, I've probably done over 1,000 episodes of television, almost 500 of them with you guys, but then another 500 or so or more. And I don't think I've ever felt a better set than the NCIS set.
And the
cast of people who've gone through our show. And the good news is, you know, you feel like family, because that's what you have. Mm-hmm. And I stay in touch with people like Michael Weatherly and Cody DiPaolo and and Mark Harmon and all those people. I just, you know, and Maria Bello. Just people like that have come through for 2 or 3 years and you're still talking to them and still enjoying them. And I still like what I haven't been on the show this year, but I enjoy watching you guys. Anna and I sit every Tuesday night and watch you guys. And I get to have fun because my name's still there.
Heck yeah.
I think you should lobby Jason and Christy. I think you gotta send them the resume, send them a headshot. You know what I mean?
You can film a little something on your iPhone.
Send it in and say, hey, you know, have you guys thought about me for something?
You're great at improvising. Let's improvise a monologue right now.
Oh, come on.
Okay, so who do you want to play in this from NCIS? Who do you want to play? You play any character?
Oh, I'm gonna play Torres.
Okay, I'm gonna play Casey.
Okay,
and you thought I was gonna say somebody else, didn't you?
If you're gonna be fun.
So we're doing a scene.
Okay, and we're gonna grill you. Okay, Casey's coming. Everybody else has the flu. It's fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
We know it was you. Casey has the DNA. Jimmy confirmed that the body was killed 2 blocks from your house.
It's all over it. The brilliant Jimmy Palmer has confirmed it.
He's handsome, his rippling abs and eyes you lose Torres, yourself please. In for days. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean.
The point is, we know it was you. What do you have to say for yourself?
I don't know how you're going to prove it. You know, I think you have lots of hearsay, lots of uncooperated evidence. I don't see how you ever would pin it on me.
I can tell you how.
Oh, yeah?
I've got this knife with your blood and your handprints all over it.
Handprints.
Torres, please.
Sorry, I was just echoing what you said.
That's what you say. You prove it in court.
Just tell us.
And I want my lawyer.
Oh, he lawyered up. They usually don't do that.
Take my knife back. And scene.
Beautiful.
I think
that was really good. Okay.
That was really good.
Jason Kennedy, I know you're the casting director for NCIS, but I feel like that audition and alone.
Yeah.
I think we may have our next.
I didn't want to throw you off, but I could see the camera. I could see the camera as you were saying that.
You could.
Pushing in. Getting closer and closer.
Not too close because, you know, I'm not comfortable with cameras.
Darling, you're beautiful.
All right. Well, that's good. Now, you gave me an idea, though. I think I'll send Jason a note. Start looking.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned that our set has become so welcoming, and I do really think that that's top-down enterprise. Yes, Mark set the tone a lot on the set, but really, I mean, you're a person that set that tone for us as a cast. And I want to say thank you so much, not just for being here today, but for doing everything you did for our lives and being that person in the audition room that was front and center and always going to bat for us for the last 23 years. Thank you so much.
Well, I didn't know I was going to come and have you stroke my ego, but thank you very much.
We've made you an actor.
Yep.
We've made you the top-down reason that the show feels good.
We talked about your Emmys, and you get a free mug.
You get a free mug.
I can keep this one, huh?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
All right, I'm going to have my coffee in the morning.
That one is yours.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Charles.
I'm sorry. I'm too lazy to get up.
I know, me too.
I already did it once. I knocked everything out.
And thank you guys for watching another episode of NCIS Partners and Probies. You can catch us each and every week on Tuesday. Please listen to us on Spotify, Odyssey, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcasts. Oh, and YouTube as well.
Latte for Keenan?
That's me.
Hey, you're...
Yeah.
Buying a car online on AutoTrader?
Really? But unlike other sites, you can start online, test drive with a local dealer, then finish online or at the dealership.
Really? Wait, are you...
Yep, it's key.
...able to finish in person without starting the process over?
Really? Your info stays with you every step of the way.
Cool. Enjoy.
It's Keenan Thompson. Buy your car online on AutoTrader. Really?
Amazon Music has everything you want to listen to. Music, podcasts, and now audiobooks. All in one app. Amazon Music Unlimited. Audiobooks included.